For more than 20 years, experts have warned about a digital Pearl Harbor, when the West's dependence on information technology would be exploited at great cost and peril. This week's guest argues that the reality of the cyber threat has proven more complex and dangerous than expected. He's Adam Siegel, this week on Story in the Public Square. Welcome to Story in the Public Square, where storytelling meets public affairs. I'm Jim Lutis from the Pell Center at Salve Regina University, and alongside me, as always, is my friend and co-host G. Wayne Miller from the Providence Journal. On this show, every week, we try to take apart the narratives that shape American public life. This week, we're talking about the role of cyberspace and geopolitics with Adam Siegel, the Ira A. Lippman Chair in Emerging Technologies and National Security, and Director of the Digital and Cyberspace Policy Program at the Council on Foreign Relations. Adam, thank you for being with us.
Thanks for having me on.
So let's start someplace really, really basic. And for the audience, when we're talking about cyberspace and cybersecurity and hacking, what are we talking about?
Well, cyberspace, I think it's useful to think about having three levels. We have the networks, the devices we use, and we want to protect those. We have the software that runs on top of all those devices. And then on top of that, we have the information itself, our identities, how we present ourselves in cyberspace. And cybersecurity basically is protecting all of those things from outside attacks, from people that want to take that data, manipulate it, or change it.
And how pervasive a threat are we talking about when we're talking about hacking?
Well, anybody that's been following the news knows it's pervasive. It's happening all the time. Massive hacks almost seem to be happening every single week. So either your loss of your data through the Equifax hack, the hack of Yahoo, but also those tend to be, seem to be criminal hacks. But we also know that nation states are increasingly using cyberspace for their own propaganda, for their own influence, and sometimes to create physical damage in the real world.
So you've described a break between Western democracies on the one hand and more authoritarian regimes such as China and Russia. Talk to us about that. What are their objectives in terms of using cyberspace and cyber attacks? And obviously this is a very broad topic, but give us an overview.
Yeah, I think there's a useful distinction between what we call cybersecurity, and Russia and China and other one-party states tend to call information security. So cybersecurity is protection of the networks, protection of the data. Information security is that plus the concern about content. So the free flow of information and what that information might do to domestic stability and regime legitimacy. So when the Russians and Chinese talk about cybersecurity or information security, they're also talking about how do you control that information? How do you make sure that information that would threaten Putin or Xi Jinping doesn't spread widely, and how can you take it down very quickly?
How do those two countries use cyberspace to control their own populations, as it were? Certainly with the thinking of the social discourse, we view ourselves, I think, correctly here in America, certainly, as more free with Facebook and so forth and so on. But it's a different situation, certainly in China.
It is. So the Chinese have what we generally refer to as the Great Firewall. So Western companies are not able to operate freely there. So Twitter, Facebook, Google are all blocked if you're a Chinese user. And while there is a very vibrant social media ecosystem in China, Weibo or WeChat, all those companies tightly censor the information that is posted there. They are legally responsible. So unlike in the US, where Facebook and Twitter are not liable for the information that's posted, Chinese companies employ thousands of censors who take down information very quickly. And the Chinese have also become increasingly technologically sophisticated in blocking things. So there was a meme that was very popular in China briefly, of pictures of President Xi Jinping compared to Tigger and Eeyore from Winnie the Pooh. Because there had been a photo of President Obama and President Xi, and they kind of walking together that looked like Eeyore and Tigger walking together.
I think I saw that.
Those photos were circulating fairly widely. The Chinese became very sophisticated, and they could block that inside of a chat. So you could be chatting with somebody, you say, here's a photo, that photo would get blocked.
Wow. Are there workarounds for Chinese citizens who don't want that degree of censorship and control, which is extreme by our, in our view, certainly?
Yeah, so lots of technologically sophisticated Chinese who travel to the United States, most college students would use a VPN, a virtual private network, and they could get around a lot of that censorship. But what we've seen in the run-up to the Party Congress, which is happening this week, that lots of VPNs were being blocked. And so access is getting harder.
What about in Hong Kong, just very quickly? Is it different in Hong Kong compared to China itself, China proper?
It is different, right? So under the terms of the agreement, when Hong Kong reverted back to the mainland, the Chinese agreed to keep the social system in place for at least 50 years. So that has included free access to the internet. So if you're a Hong Kong user, you can get access to Facebook and Twitter. But we do know that the Chinese, for example, have hacked into the email accounts of Hong Kong dissidents. They have attacked people that were interested in more Hong Kong independence and the democracy movement. Those people have been under attack.
So, you know, when you talk about sort of this different approach between Western liberal democracies and the one-party states, that it almost seems like there is that the different approaches to whether it's cybersecurity or it is information security is more deeply grounded in the political culture, the political context, than it is just simply a function of personalities. Is that a safe assumption?
It is, and I think, you know, we had an assumption in the U.S. and in Europe as well, is that the internet was going to be this wide open space, right, that was built to share information. And the Chinese and Russians have never seen it that way. They saw the internet as increasingly economically important, right? The Chinese didn't want to miss out on that wave of innovation. But they never thought, well, yeah, of course it was going to be completely wide open and free. So from the very beginning, the Chinese and Russians saw the internet as a double-edged sword, one that was going to drive the economy, but was going to create these bad political and social outcomes, and they were going to have to control it.
And is you know, once upon a time, American foreign policy was predicated upon opening the world to the free flow of information.
Yeah.
Right. And so you think about the Cold War; it wasn't just sort of the physical barrier in Europe between East and West, but it was also a block on information. And so we did everything from helium balloon launches to radio in the American sector to Radio Free Europe and Radio Liberty to penetrate the Iron Curtain with information. Has the West's approach to information and essentially proselytizing the value of free information changed in the 21st century?
Well, under the Obama administration, we had what was called the Internet Freedom Agenda, right? So Secretary Clinton made a series of speeches in 2010 and 2011 that basically said that, you know, the divisions moving forward are going to be between open societies and closed societies, and we're going to promote an open internet, and in fact that the rights we have in the real world are the same rights we have online. So freedom of information, freedom of association, all these things, that is going to be our foreign policy for the internet. That got us into a lot of trouble, right? That basically a lot of countries, as we said, you know, don't like that view, and that affiliated kind of the U.S. view with the internet and the tech companies in particular, Google and Facebook and others. The Trump administration currently, you know, they've made it fairly clear that democracy promotion is not one of their priorities. And so I would be very surprised if this internet freedom agenda also falls, you know, much farther down. The speech that Secretary Tillerson gave about, yes, we have our values, but sometimes we're not going to be able to promote them, I think it's going to be one of those, internet is going to be one of those spaces.
So talk a little bit about what is bundled under the term Russian hacking into our election in 2016.
Yeah.
I mean, that encompasses, certainly as time goes on, as we learn more, it encompasses more and more components.
Yeah.
Give us sort of an overview of of what the components were and what Russia was hoping to achieve.
Yeah, I think if we think of them as information operations, or using the Russian term active measures, right? It seems as if there was some hacking, the hacking of the DNC emails and of John Podesta's private email account. That involves hacking, right? You break into the systems, you take the emails, and then you distribute them through WikiLeaks or DC Leaks or some other public website thing. That was one component of it, and that's where the original focus was on. What we've seen since the election, as more and more information comes out, is they also seem to have used Twitter bots, so automated systems on Twitter that pushed fake news or fake information, mainly to try and play on existing social divisions, right? So red state versus blue state, feminists versus more conservative people, and basically just to try to aggravate that. We also see that they bought ads on Facebook that were targeted towards individuals. And that information is now coming out about how they use that as well.
Yeah, and Facebook was before Congress quite recently talking about that. And Zuckerberg seems to have changed his tune regarding the quote-unquote freedom of Facebook in that regard.
Yes, I think what we'll see is, you know, right now we have public laws about advertising on the political advertising in the media, right? You have to say, I paid for this ad, I approved it. That's not true on social media. That I think is very likely to change.
It's interesting though, because that's only going to solve part of the problem, because they also just sort of faked Americans, right? And so you think about some of these accounts like Blacktivist,
right,
who was, by all accounts, it appears now to be a Russian-controlled account. It was not, and it was had 300,000 followers, but that's not going to be covered by a political advertising reform in social media. But I want to pick up on this thread a little bit though, because since the 1990s, we've had stories about cybersecurity couched in the terms of we need to prevent a digital Pearl Harbor, and after 9/11, a digital 9/11. Seemed to be a broad consensus that the threat was to the physical world, that someone was going to use the internet to hack a dam and flood open some river and drown a lot of people, or they were going to turn the lights off in New York City, that there was going to be some physical manifestation of that. So I guess there are two questions. One is, have we seen physical results of hacking? And two, did we just completely miss the attack would be in cyberspace, but the attack would be use cyberspace as a delivery vehicle for an influence campaign?
Yeah. So
those are two big questions.
We've seen maybe 1.5 on the physical side. The only attack we know that's caused physical damage is the attack that's known as Stuxnet or Olympic Games, which was the malware that destroyed centrifuges in Natanz, the Iranian nuclear program. So that was a U.S.-Israel operation. That's the only attack we know that physically caused damage, caused the centrifuges to spin too quickly or too slowly, opened and closed valves, and caused physical destruction. The 0.5 would be, which seems to be Russian-based hackers of the power grid in Kiev. That caused a power outage for about 4 or 5 hours in December, which is not a time you want to be without power in Ukraine. So there is a threat there, and that threat is growing as more and more devices are connected to the Internet of Things, to cause physical outcomes. I think we were overly focused on those threats. I think part of that was political, because there are lots of people who argue that cybersecurity wasn't getting enough attention, right? It's the kind of thing that policymakers didn't truly understand, or they didn't understand the internet, they didn't understand the threat. And so digital 9/11 or digital Pearl Harbor was a narrative that got people's attention, right? They could understand that, oh, you don't want the Russians or the Chinese to destroy a chemical factory and cause things. So that was the kind of organizing principle that was unfortunately slightly hyperbolic, that tried to drive the argument forward. Those type of threats are hard to do. They're very likely to be a nation state, not a terrorist group. And they're deterred, or they're deterrable, right? The Chinese and Russians are not going to turn the lights off out of the blue, right? there's going to be blowback. They're going to know that the U.S. eventually is going to attribute to that to them. Countries like Iran and North Korea are much harder to deter, and they are becoming more capable. So I think it was an organizing principle. I think it did blind us to the possible information operations. We knew that the Russians did this. We knew, but we thought, oh, they're just going to do it to their neighbors, right? They're going to do it to the Baltics. They're going to do it to Ukraine. They wouldn't dare do it to the United States.
We need to take a quick moment for station identification. This is Story in the Public Square, where storytelling meets public affairs. An audio version of this program can be heard three times each weekend on SiriusXM Satellite Radio's popular Politics of the United States channel. That's the POTUS channel, 124. And you can download episodes anytime on the SiriusXM app. The show is produced each week by a wonderful, talented, and generous crew at Rhode Island PBS in beautiful Providence, Rhode Island. We're lucky to work with them. I'm Jim Lutis from the Pell Center at Salve Regina University, and you can follow me on Twitter at JM Lutis. To my right, my colleague is G. Wayne Miller, an award-winning journalist with the Providence Journal. He's also the author of 17 books at last count. He's on Twitter too, at G. Wayne Miller. And our guest this week, Adam Siegel, has been published in, well, let's just say every important English language outlet. He's also the author of the new book, The Hacked World Order: How Nations Fight, Trade, Maneuver, and Manipulate in the Digital Age. So Adam, let's talk for a minute about the book. What drove you to write it?
Basically, in some sense, it was the desire to make the history of the digital age more than just one damn hack after another, right? Mm-hmm. We had basically entered a point where I would go give a talk about cybersecurity and people would say, oh, this hack happened. It's a great time to give this talk. And that became every day. So it was an attempt to try to understand why we were seeing so much hacking and what it is that nation states were trying to accomplish in that space.
I want to go to sort of a lower level of hacking, as it were. We've been reading a lot recently in the New York Times and other places about states increasingly concerned about voting. You know, we have an election coming up in 2018 and years going forward. And what I've read indicates that in many states, or certainly in many regions, you're dealing with antiquated software. You're dealing with systems that could easily be hacked. What is that threat, number one? And number two, how do we counteract that? Because not every region or state has the resources to buy state-of-the-art, quote-unquote, non-hackable software.
Yeah, so there is no non-hackable software. I mean, any software is going to be hackable. The threat seems to be that you could, if not change the ballots, you could still mess with voter rolls, you could make it difficult to report the results. And what we've seen to see in the 2016 election was that there was some, if not hacking of the systems, at least some kind of mapping of them, penetration of them to see what's out there. And you wouldn't have to manipulate all of them. You could just manipulate one or two in important
a
swing
key
states.
District, yeah.
A key district,
yeah, absolutely.
The problem is, as you kind of alluded to, is that there are hundreds of thousands of voting districts. This happens at the state and local level. Resources immensely differ. I think we have turned a corner. I think in 2016, you saw a lot of the states push back and say, you know, we're fine, we don't have a problem.
Yeah.
That's changing. I think
that is changing.
You're seeing lots of states saying, well, actually, we could use the help. After 2016, the DHS, the Department of Homeland Security, finally designated electoral systems as critical infrastructure, which means that the federal government can provide support if it's requested or is needed. And I think lots of places are saying there's no reason to computerize this, right? Paper ballots are useful. You can count them, you can reproduce them, and we're going to go back to those types of systems. We saw last year in the Dutch election, they said we're going to paper.
Really, entirely
to
paper.
We're going to vote on paper.
Yeah, Rhode Island just recently passed legislation to mandate random audits of statewide elections. Is that something you think will have traction?
I think it will. I think we're going to start seeing best practices kind of spread around, either random audits or backups of systems, paper things. All these things, I think, are being discussed.
So one of the things that I've heard you talk about is this, and I think it speaks to this difference between cybersecurity and information security. But there's a legal issue right now between Microsoft and the U.S. government about the physical location of where data is stored. For our audience, walk us through that story.
So what happens is with the cloud, right, there's an efficiency to storing data globally, right? I'm a US user, but my data could be in Ireland, it could be in other places. Of course, if you're a law enforcement agency and I commit a crime, you want access to that data. Generally, that's not a problem, right? I'm a U.S. citizen. I'm located in the United States, but I can turn around and access data. But if you are a Brazilian court and two Brazilians plan a crime using WhatsApp, and you want that data. You turn around to Facebook and you say, "Give us the data." And Facebook says, "You know, we're a U.S. company. The data is stored probably in Ireland or the U.S. If you want that data, you have to come through what's called an MLAT process, a mutual legal assistance treaty. So Brazilian court has to go through that treaty. It may take 8 or 10 months to get that data. So they don't want to do that, right? It threatens their sovereignty and is long and drawn out. In the case of the U.S. versus Ireland, U.S. drug dealer or alleged drug dealer, the U.S. Department of Justice wants that data, and Microsoft says, "Sorry, that data is stored in Ireland. If you want that, you have to go through this process." Courts originally ruled in favor of the Department of Justice, said you're a U.S. company, you have to turn it over. Then the appeal court said, "No, you have to go through the process. This is in Ireland." Now the Supreme Court has taken up the case. But the larger issue is that there are efficiencies to storing the data globally, but we live in a world of sovereignty and territoriality. So how we're going to work out who gets access to the data, how they get access to the data, is one of the big questions that we're seeing states play out in this kind of geopolitical environment.
So that data is not stored, obviously, in a cloud. It's stored on the ground in facilities, data banks or farms or whatever you want to call them. Dropbox has them, Facebook does, Google, and so forth and so on. So those are actual physical facilities located somewhere. Are those safe? And I'm thinking safe from natural disaster. I'm thinking safe from explosion. I'm thinking safe from power overload.
Yeah, so there'll be.
I want to know that, like, my intellectual property that I store in Dropbox isn't going to, like.
Justine's book.
That's it. End of my books.
Dropbox is going to have more than one facility, right?
Okay.
So,
and they back up.
They back up. Okay. And so if that one, I don't know what Dropbox facilities are, but if there's an earthquake that takes out that one, they're going to have two more in the United States and probably in other countries. So,
but we trust Dropbox to do that. I mean, I don't personally know that they do it.
Well, that's
I
why
believe they do
that's
that.
Why it's good to use a big name cloud storage company. Amazon or Microsoft or Dropbox or any of these companies are going to have multiple redundancies.
Okay.
Some guy comes down the street and says, "I have a cloud system for you." I would be slightly more
skeptical.
More skeptical until he tells me I have two or three facilities.
So
there.
You've said elsewhere that when you finished writing the book, American cyber power was at its zenith.
Yeah.
And we're now in a state of decline. Why?
Part of that was self-inflicted, right? So Edward Snowden releases a lot of documents that show the scope of the U.S. Reach, right? We can pretty much reach anywhere. The vast majority at the time of U.S. of traffic, internet traffic, was going through U.S. backbones, and that gave U.S. intelligence agencies a huge leg up. And the rest of the world didn't like that, right? They discovered that they didn't want their traffic to go through the U.S. They didn't like the fact that Microsoft and other companies had to turn over data to the U.S. government because of Patriot Act and other Section 702 of other surveillance laws. And so they started saying, "We don't want U.S. companies here. We want to replace you with Chinese companies or European companies or other things." So there was a self-inflected side of it, but a lot of it is just, quite honestly, is demographics. Is that the vast majority of the internet population is already lives in Asia and is going to grow even more, right? So only about 375 million users in India, which means that there's another 800 million users to come online.
Wow.
So India is adding 5 to 7 million users a month. And even China, which is around 700 million, still 750 million, still has another 500 million users to come online. So those users are going to be younger than American users, and they're going to have a different conception of privacy and security and identity and all these things that we're trying to figure out in the United States. And that kind of gravity is going to really shape the future, I think, of the internet.
So we were talking a little bit in the green room about what you did before you got onto cyber, and that was involved with China. Talk about that, because I found that absolutely Fascinating. So your timing, by the way, is good.
Yes.
China and now cyber.
So the previous book was on Chinese innovation strategy and how, in particular, the Chinese don't want to rely on the West for critical technologies. That's been a major theme of Chinese history since the 1870s and 1880s. There was a movement called the Self-Strengthening Movement, which was, we want to bring in Western technology. We don't want Western ideas. And so what we see now is the Chinese trying to do that. Part of the reason why this book was on cyber espionage and hacking was because the Chinese were stealing a lot of that information, intellectual property. Was one way about how they could try to move up the value chain. And we're entering a new stage of competition, in particular over artificial intelligence. Mm. The Chinese have a lot of advantages, right? They have all of this data. They use the internet and they use, in particular, social media and phone apps in ways that we don't do, right? For most of their purchasing, WeChat, which is the very popular social media thing, has lots of things built into it that we don't have in our systems about paying your rent and paying you. So they can have access to a lot of data and they don't have the same concerns over privacy that US users do. And they have a government that's spending a lot of money on it. So it's going to be a big competition between the U.S. And China there. And the two kind of have blended into each other with the way that the Chinese have stolen intellectual property.
So we've only got about 45 seconds left. What keeps you up at night?
I am actually not that worried about, a digital Pearl Harbor, a cyber thing. The things that most worry me are the types of hacks that we've seen increasingly, which are hacks on individuals that take their data and, put it on the web. For reputational damage or for political reasons. So those are the things that I would be most worried about as an individual and as an institution, right? Do you know what your most valuable data is? Do you know where it is? Do you know who has access to it? Do you have the right controls on it?
Remarkable. Adam, thank you so much for being with us. He's Adam Siegel. The book is The Hacked World Order. If you liked this episode and want to know more about storing the public square, you can visit us at pellcenter.org. We can also catch up on past episodes. You can always find us on Facebook and Twitter. He's G. Wayne Miller. I'm Jim Lutis, asking you to join us again next week for more Story in the Public Square.